Welcome to Fire Your Therapist, a podcast with a radical perspective on mental health. Here are your hosts, Carrie and Dan.
Welcome to Fire Your Therapist. You're listening to our special How Does This Make You Feel episode.
It's also known as our Wow, That's Interesting episode.
Yeah. Very similar to the Tell Me More episode.
I mean, jokes aside, I think that this is a good episode to have. If you can't tell what we're going to talk about, we're going to talk about traditional roles, techniques, tools, things that we're learning that therapists are supposed to do, right? Roles that they put on to practice. And now this episode might be a little bit tongue-in-cheek. We're going to check in, and then we're going to talk about these topics. Dan, is there anything you want to check in about?
Yeah, the one thing I would say is that I have a lot of fun making fun of traditional psychotherapy techniques, but I'm also a trainer of psychotherapists, as are you. And we've done some work on deconstructing modalities, and so we kind of, our critique is pretty well founded. It's not just us making fun.
Yeah, no, that's true. And in my check-in, I guess I want to share that some of our opinions are going to contradict a lot of things that people have learned in their training programs, if there are any aspiring therapists listening. And it's going to probably contradict things that they learned at school. And that's fine, because there are a lot of theories and techniques that we've learned in both of those places that have been used in the history of psychotherapy. But I think we're going to make an argument today that, yeah, they've been used, but were they useful? I don't know. Sustainability is the first topic that comes up for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the more, especially in recent years, with the push towards brief and effectiveness-based, which there's a whole topic right there, is deconstructing the idea of effectiveness, but has led to a push towards modalities that can quickly create the appearance of change, no matter how unsustainable.
Of course.
And then those are the modalities that get the most support and attention, and you know, people want to be trained in, and institutions think are really valuable. And at the end of the day, we have no less people in counseling. We have no like significantly different outcomes from counseling than we did before these effectiveness-based and brief modalities were in use. So it really just looks better from an insurance standpoint.
Right. And it brings up for me the idea of measurable growth. So there are modalities out there that would say, for example, anything that has to deal with DHM paperwork, they would say, has your client improved? And let's measure that. And here's how you would measure it. And the measurements are then, you know, sent to a place called an insurance company where they're going to verify whether or not what you're doing is working. And it just begs the question, how can you possibly measure development and growth and well-being? You can measure behaviors and symptoms and things like that, but there's just so much you cannot measure.
Right. And those measures are so short-term and I would say somewhat artificial.
Absolutely.
I don't remember the statistic exactly, but it's something around 50%. It's about half of everybody that goes to therapy for maybe one or two sessions and doesn't stay with it. Mm-hmm. Whatever problem they were seeking therapy for resolves itself within 6 months.
Of course, yeah.
Regardless.
Naturally.
So there's a lot of overlap between like time and growth and other things happening in people's lives that I think psychotherapy sometimes takes credit for.
Right. Okay, so the measurement would begin with like a baseline. So the presenting problem, they would say, someone comes in, I am X, Y, and Z. Okay, I am depressed. I am anxious. I have an eating disorder, whatever they're coming in saying that they would like to talk about or work on. And then at the end or 6 months in or a year in, they're going to measure it again and see if there's been any change. Now, let's look at the evidence. Almost every theory would agree that the relationship or the rapport between the client and the therapist is the most important part of psychotherapy across the board. I don't think there's any modality that would disagree.
Right.
That is the most important. Okay, so then the fact that you are sitting with someone every week, and I have to say, almost every experience I've ever had working with someone in psychotherapy work is that they would say, I have no one else to talk to. It's so helpful that you're here for me every week. And it doesn't really matter what we talk about. just having someone to go see,
right,
and you get an hour that's about
you. Contact.
Yeah. It's contact, period, to be right. honest, because I could have a million people in my life and none of them of which that I would be vulnerable with or share anything with.
Right.
And it makes a world of difference to have someone. So then 6 months of sitting with someone, listening to you or spending time with you in any regard, right, where there's money being exchanged in service of helping you. You know, there are so many pieces of that, that 6 months in, there will be improvement regardless, in my opinion.
Right. Well, that brings up sort of a smart ass term I heard once, which is rent a friend.
Right.
Right. And if we across the board acknowledge that 6 months of sitting with someone and being in good contact with them, listening, exchanging, supporting, et cetera, mm-hmm, what are we doing to make that change sustainable? Mm-hmm. And to get out of this rent-a-friend critique, wouldn't it be better if those same therapists were, instead of just providing that experience, they were changing the person's social context so that they weren't giving them an experience that couldn't be replicated outside of therapy, right? If for 6 months this person is telling you you're the only person they have this contact with.
Yes, can you teach them to build that?
Right. Right. Or elsewhere. Do you hear that and think, oh, well, I'm glad they come to me. I mean, I'm so valuable. I'm so important to them. I'm the only one they have. I better keep doing this for the rest of their life for them.
Right. What a great income.
Right. What a great income. But instead they should be thinking, oh, this is a problem in the social context.
Yeah.
This isn't a personal problem.
Right.
Right.
If they're coming and seeing you for a year and they still have no, there's no risk taking in their life. Now, granted, there are some people that are going to need years of care before they're ready to take any risks to build supports in their own life.
Sure. But I would advocate that the care they might need is care provided by a community of support, not an individual.
Right. Okay. Well, hold on. Can I pause? Because one of the first things I brought up was sustainability. And I would want to clarify that we mean sustainability in the way that we're saying is the growth and the care and the healing and whatever words you want to use being sustained.
Right, that the change, right, that we're the not change talking is about, sustainable.
Exactly, that the yeah. change is sustainable. We're not talking about sustainability in a very environmental.
Right, right.
So anyway, I've had that confused when I talk about sustainability before. We're talking right. about, does the therapy work long term?
Absolutely. And I mean, the big thing that comes down to, can a therapist try to change someone's context? And I said an ethical one.
Uh-huh.
Is because it seems a little socially unjust to me if we know very well that a context would lead to the anxiety, to the depression, to the suffering, to whatever's going on. And we try to adjust somebody to tolerate that context better, but we don't work with them to change the context.
Right, exactly. Okay, let right. me present something. Here's something that I learned in school and whatever. Just every time you hear about psychotherapy, you hear about the identified patient or the presenting problem. Now just think about the language. The identified patient. So then now the emphasis is on the individual. There's something wrong with them. And then you're supposed to identify the presenting problem as if it, and first of all, if anybody knows anything about diagnosing and they know the different axes that you can talk about, I'm always filling up the one that has to do with environmental concerns. Mm-hmm. And I think that the emphasis is that that's an afterthought. Oh, and there's right. also these other things happening in their lives, and that's no right. good for their axis one, axis two, axis three. But I think that it should be inverted. I think that if you're thinking about environmental factors first, then you're really taking into account
right.
that the same person in two different contexts would have very different lives, different symptoms, different right. feelings, different experiences.
Right away, I mean, there's probably a lot of modalities that we could pick at, but right away, that makes me want to call out the whole Rogerian client-centered mm-hmm. approach as nonsense, because if somebody was truly client-centered, wouldn't they want to honor the perspective of their client's experience and fill out access four, right? The psychosocial mm-hmm. first, so that they were filling out the others from the perspective of their client's experience.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Right. If you're so client-centered, how come your entire perspective on them excludes them?
I don't know. I think there's a power dynamic that is, I don't know, assumed that if you've gone to school and you have the experience and you have the techniques and
you're... That we know better.
Right. Let's talk about some techniques. There are some techniques out there. Tools, I would say, that I learned in school. And I think I learned from about these things from a theory perspective. So certain theories
right.
are known for certain tools and techniques.
Right.
They have fallbacks. Not only is it a safety net when you don't know what to do, but I remember there being some sort of sense of urgency for young trainees to learn techniques and tools before even entering a room. Like, okay, right. here's some equipment. Now go in and now you'll be fine.
Right. Yeah, we could pick apart a lot of those. I think the one thing I would throw out for anybody listening to this is most of those theories do not have a theory of change.
How do you mean?
They all presume that assessing the problem and intervening on it is a theory of change, and it's not. There mm-hmm. is no really well-articulated theory of change for most psychotherapy. Not all. A lot of it does have very specific theory. Like, what are the conditions that lead to change in human lives and development and experience? Not psychotherapy, but for humans in general.
Mm-hmm.
What leads humans to have a certain experience? And unfortunately, a lot of modalities have a deficit-based perspective. So they're not looking at what changes somebody or what builds their experience in their life. They're looking at what are the glitches that we should fix. And if you're deficit-based, all you're going to do is bring somebody out of triage to, at best, like a neutral baseline. If you're actually trying to get someone to what leads to a happy and fulfilling life, you know, duct taping problems and putting on Band-Aids just stops the bleeding.
So let's talk about the Band-Aids and duct tape. So, like, what are we considering that? I think we need to make that really explicit. I don't know for you, but the first thing that comes to my mind is CBT.
Absolutely.
And the reason that comes to mind is because it's a very top-down approach. It's not experience-based.
Right.
We're not at all trying to help a client have an experience in the room in real time. We're saying, well, tell us about the thoughts. Tell us about the behaviors. We will come up with a technique or a way or a plan to fix that. And hopefully you'll have a different experience down the road.
Right. And I don't want to totally discount the logic of connecting beliefs and behaviors, but they are far too often used as a workaround for the underlying issue.
Right. No, I think
they're
so.
Good
That's
for,
what I'm
they're
saying.
They're good for triage,
uh-huh.
But they're not sustainable if the underlying cause is greater than the tiny habit that they target. Yeah.
So there's something about having a lived experience of something that automatically is changing your thoughts and behaviors. If you come up with an example of something, you know, if you've been through something very life-changing, let's say a car accident, while you were texting, okay? I texted every day before the accident. Now I've been in this very traumatizing experience, and I will never text again, right? Look how fast that behavior is going to change because I had an experience first.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I could come up with a plan. So let's say there was no accident. I could come up with a plan to teach myself to stop texting. I could put my phone in the trunk or whatever. How sustainable is that really if you haven't had an emotional experience, something that you lived through attached to it?
Right.
How many people have actually changed their behaviors because someone they know is going through something really rough? Like, oh, I stopped drinking because, you know, my friend got a DUI.
Right.
Which is, it's even a vicarious experience.
I think one of the most unsustainable functions that therapists try to offer their clients is a perfect holding space, a perfect, compassionate, accepting space.
Okay.
And that sounds maybe great to some people in theory, but if that person's struggle is, I don't get that experience in my relationships.
Uh-huh.
And you give that to them, which feels really good, and they're going to thank you for it, and you're going to think you're the best therapist ever. Aren't you really just training them to depend on you? And dependence is a whole different conversation. I think everybody depends on lots of things, so I'm not saying dependence of itself is bad. But that therapist probably isn't doing that on purpose. saying, let me be the one thing that does this for you forever.
Now, here's the point that I would add to what you're saying, is that, okay, so let's say out of our natural personality and the way we are with people in our lives, we naturally have a holding space for anyone that comes to us for support. That's just how we are. Or we're doing it as a gesture of, oh, okay, I'd like to see where you're at and I'm going to offer you this thing, without any knowledge that they don't have this in their life. Now, there's the traditional model that would say that is correct. You should keep the holding space. That is very important in psychotherapy. That is something you should always do. Mm-hmm. And then there's what we're saying is, okay, that could happen actually naturally. I could have a holding space for a client intentionally or unintentionally. Let's say it happens. Am I having a conversation about what is it like to have this space now that you've shared with me that you don't have this anywhere else? And right. And what if I had a difficult day and I wasn't able to hold the space as well as right. I am right now? How would that impact our relationship? Would it be triggering for you? Would it bring up, some fight or flight of, oh no, the space is right. gone. What do I do? And is that conversation happening, I think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's so important to model that's unsustainable for you as a therapist.
Oh yeah.
Otherwise you're setting up a completely unattainable illusion of what it looks like to be, I'm doing air quotes right now, healthy and well-adjusted.
Uh-huh.
Right? If your therapist never comments on how difficult it is to hold that space for you, mm-hmm. then your illusion constantly is that, well, when I get better, I'll be like my therapist. I'll never have any trouble holding the space and always being like eager and happy to listen, and I'll be just like that. The other thing that comes to mind for me is then it makes the rest of their life a total disappointment.
Right.
Everybody right. else who's going to have their opinions, their disagreements, reject them sometimes, not be able to listen when they want to talk. Mm-hmm. It sets up this totally unreplicable relationship.
That's right. It's sort of going from one extreme to the complete opposite extreme, and neither are sustainable.
Right.
What it reminds me of is that there could be someone who has absolutely no one to talk to in their life, complete isolation. Then they go to therapy, which is an opposite experience. There's someone holding space, time, and resources for you every week. And you're going to go there and have that. And you don't have it anywhere else. No one to listen, no one to sit with. So there's this thing happening that has never happened to you, possibly. And it's like you've been starved your whole life, and now you're offered the most delicious meal you've ever had. And you're likely to gorge yourself on this,
Right.
And to keep wanting it every week.
Right.
And then there's this, I don't know how to explain it, maybe a counter shame. So, oh my gosh, I have this delicious meal. I want it. I want this therapy. I want this resource. It's finally available. You can kind of lose yourself in the wonderfulness of having this need met. And then you go to the other extreme of, okay, I finally get to have this thing I never had before. But when you leave, it's still not there. So not like you were saying earlier. So now there's this thing that you have to continue to consume because it's so appetizing.
Right.
But are you leaving any space for something in the middle to happen where you can build the supports for that thing you need in your life? Now, no relationship is like that, where there's one listener and one talker.
Right.
Or the opposite.
Absolutely.
No one to listen, and you you're alone with yourself. Neither is sustainable.
I love the food metaphor, because you could describe, after like starving and being hungry for something that you never get, mm-hmm. finding a therapist, and it looks like, unless you're a vegan out there, it looks like a steak dinner, right? It's this amazing thing. Mm-hmm. But it's really McDonald's. It's really like artificial flavors and substances and, right?
Okay.
It's really not a steak dinner. It's really a manufactured, it's like the Matrix, right? The signals in your brain that say you're eating a steak dinner are going off. You're not actually eating, right? Uh-huh. The therapist is playing a role to simulate right. you having this experience, right? Yeah. So it just reinforces how unsustainable that is, because
uh-huh.
you couldn't live on that either. And people probably try to pretty frequently. And I would say, because their therapist relies on their payment as income, mm-hmm. it's very rare that therapists say, actually, you know what? You probably shouldn't keep paying me. You know, we've done this for 9 months. I think you've got the resilience. You should really be doing other things. Why don't you join a book club or go volunteer somewhere? Or, I mean, these are silly examples, but...
Oh, no, Dan. Now, so many people would criticize you for saying that. They would be like, why would you send them away? They need you. And now there's something that not only is there pressure put on the therapist to continue to hold the space, even though there's a possibility they think there's something going on that should be attended to, they're going to continue to give. Now, I've felt this, and many people practicing have felt this, that, wow, they really need me. And they really need me to continue doing what I'm doing because I can actually see the pain that they're in, that they don't get this anywhere else. And if I can give it, well, then I'm going to. Mm-hmm. Because it means so much to them and it's the least I can do. And it can be a very gratifying feeling to provide something people really need. I mean, I can't tell you how wonderful it is when someone, you know, meets a need that I have and how grateful I can be. And I don't want anyone to take that away unless it's not sustainable. Now, let's say that that therapist finally says, well, you know, I've been sitting here listening and I know that this is something that you haven't gotten most of the time in your life. So, you know, we've been doing this and we've been practicing it, but let's experiment with something else. How painful could that possibly be to have that then taken away? You know, okay, I'm going to take the plate away and you don't get to eat anymore. What's that like? Oh, wow. There's the possibility you lose a client. And if you're in private practice, then you lose an income.
Yeah.
And no, that's a risk.
It's a good point. It's definitely a good point. And I'm not going to disagree with that point too much. I mean, I do have clients that I've seen for 3 years. But I would not have continued that long without having numerous conversations about the sustainability of it financially. Mm-hmm. And about conversations about what else they're doing in their life so that they're not relying on me as the only outlet and support they have for certain things.
As the only outlet.
Right.
I think is important.
Absolutely.
So
either... Absolutely. But I the one thing I will say that's going to sound maybe not controversial, but a little potentially punitive of therapists out there is I think half of that might really come from therapists' own ego and wanting to be that person that's so important and provides so much support, and that they can't tell the difference between that and their professional identity. The two overlap. And so feeling so important and so needed by someone gets translated in their head to, oh, I'm a really good therapist. I'm doing a really good job. This is what I'm supposed to do. I'll keep doing it.
Yeah, good point.
And I'm not saying the two are easily separable. I'm not saying people should quit working with someone immediately, but I am saying it's a little unexamined.
Sure.
And, you know,
I think there's a point here where we can start to wrap up and check out. There's so many ways we could go on this topic. I'm sure there are going to be so many future podcasts related to this or tying back into it. There's one piece that I want to check out with. I want to just acknowledge that. So the metaphor with the food, someone who's been starving their whole life and they finally get to eat the delicious meal and their need is met. There's also the possibility that the food is put in front of them and they don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. They've never had it before. They wouldn't even know how to eat it. And so the right. metaphor is going to, of course, translate to, I've been alone my whole life and now I have someone to listen to me and I don't even have anything to say now because I've never actually practiced speaking to someone. It's like a dog chasing a car. He wouldn't know what to do if he actually caught it, right? Anyway, I just want to throw that out there that the opposite experience could happen and I've seen happen.
Sure, sure, me too.
And I think it comes from years of being one way and to be another way. I mean, it's a very long-term process of change and of practicing something new.
Right. Well, I think the thing I would say in closing, and I sort of hope this sparks a bit of a reaction from some people and they email us and we can open a dialogue about it. But if you're currently seeing a therapist, mm-hmm. and if you are a therapist listening to this, then you can take the clues from what I'm saying also. But if you're currently seeing a therapist and that therapist doesn't engage you about your social context and doesn't dive into your strategies for building and maintaining a complex and rich and supportive social context, even with the struggles of difficult relationships, if they don't talk to you about social activism, about living based on values, about bringing things into therapy that people usually pretend is neutral. If they don't disagree with you, if they don't risk getting in arguments with you, if they don't expose their humanity to you, I would say you should fire your therapist.
If anybody has any feedback, you can email us at feedback@fireyourtherapistshow.com, or you can visit our website. Fire Your Therapist is brought to you by Yumi Media. Yumi Media offers a very custom production solution with quite intentional design. I can say for myself that when we started Fire Your Therapist, we really only had an idea. When we approached Yumi Media, they took care of everything else, everything. They designed our logos, they put us on iTunes, made a website. They made it possible for us to not only record the audio, but they brought the equipment. And although we're a small-scale production based in Los Angeles, you know, Yumi Media is based in Los Angeles, so it's not only convenient for us, but I know that they work overseas. They travel for different, you know, large-scale productions like conferences. They bring everything, lighting, video, audio, photography, anything that you would need for any sort of production or conference. They bring it. And then when they're done, they do post-production, editing, audio, video, everything. You really only need to have an idea. So if you have a project that you're looking to work on, please contact Yumi Media. Send in your questions and they'll let you know how that they can work with you in a very custom way that fits exactly what you're trying to do on your project. They really honor your ideas, and I think that that's the best part about them. Please contact them at info@yumimedia.com. Or go to their website, yumimedia.com, and that's spelled YOUMIMEDIA.com. You can also call them 310-989-0138.
Fire Your Therapist was produced by Yumi Media. Subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes or go to fireyourtherapistshow.com, where you can find podcasts, resources, and more.